Hi, everyone. Welcome. Thank you all for coming. My name is Tara Lyons, and I work in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. I want to say hello to our friends on the live stream, and also note that we do have Wi-Fi in this auditorium, and the password should be on the slide just to my left. I'm going to welcome to the stage the U.S. Chief Technology Officer, Megan Smith. Thank you.
Thank you, Tara. Thanks to Tara, her team, our UAVSI folks who are here, and welcome everybody. It's exciting to be together, and we want to again welcome folks on the live stream. This is an exciting day. It is definitely about our Jetson future. There's this space in 3D that we're starting to figure out how to really understand more about how we're going to leverage the ability to use these UAVs, these drones, for all kinds of applications. And so many people in this room are champions and leaders of that. I want to really thank colleagues for all the remarkable commitments and work that everybody's been doing. There's a fact sheet out with a lot of details that I encourage those online to go and look at. We have NASA in the house. We have NOAA in the house. We have the NSF team here. We have Department of Interior. And I know that there's some wonderful displays outside that I hope people will go and enjoy and see sort of the vision of where they're taking us and many others from the government side as well as industry side. I know that the NSF team is making a $35 million commitment today around R&D support of this sector. And other colleagues are making commitments around the kinds of applications we could be using from the federal government side. And so I encourage people to take a look at those and others. I think today we'll be talking about those as well. We're joined by Administrator Huerta and our amazing FAA team. So thank you. And thank you for the extraordinary work that you all have been doing with industry and with everybody around figuring out the safety and regulation ways to move forward as we come to understand this space and drive for the wonderful applications that are here. It was fun last night. I saw that our 4-H colleagues have announced a drone contest for young people in October. And so just thinking about what young people will do, I remember when I was younger seeing that idea of the Powers of 10. I don't know if how many people saw those movies sort of zooming out into outer space and zooming down into the body, and the idea of point of view and perspective. And one of the greatest things about being able to participate as a young person with a UAS system is certainly the cameras and being able to see the Earth and see the planet. And I know that yesterday we had an entire session about soils in the White House, about soil and soil readiness. And some of the team from the U.S. Department of Agriculture was talking about their work with young people in the 4-H and in the Future Farmers America and the work that they're doing around geo and just the sector of agriculture and the applications there, not only visually, but also with data science and other things about understanding crops and feeding everyone and bringing young people into that. So every sector here has much to gain. I also want to thank the NTIA team and others who led us. There was a lot of leadership around privacy and understanding in a multi-stakeholder process how to approach that. There's now guidelines and best practice, and colleagues from industry are really stepping up, not only stepped up into that conversation with academia and others, but also to join in and now implement those best practices and evolve those and understand those further. So as we work to create safe, amazing opportunities, we're going to kick off, I know, in a little bit, both with some opening remarks and then with some wonderful lightning talks. One of the things that I'm hopeful about is just the diversity in this area and how we engage each other. I always look to history to find interesting things, and one of the stories that I've come across recently is not only that of the Wright brothers themselves, but also their sister Catherine. And I didn't realize that she, as a teacher, used to get all of the other teachers to, as they left work, to run out in the fields and participate and be part of the invention of flight. And so I wanted to bring that image of them in the room and the Americans working together in those days and how everybody was involved and make sure that we're doing the work that we need to do in this sector to make sure we're engaging all Americans into this incredible economic and a social opportunity that we have for the future of the third dimension that we're exploring today. And so bring them in. And also a shout out to New York State, who's amongst some of the our state and local teammates. I'm from Buffalo, and so I was happy to see their commitments here with $5 million coming into supporting the growth of this emerging sector in their state, and so many other colleagues at the local, state, and tribal level who are joining us. So I'm going to turn it over to the administrator and go from there. And I really thank everybody for being here. I'm really looking forward to the lightning talks. We have an extraordinary breadth of speakers that are going to talk about a range of activities in every sector you could imagine today. And it'll be exciting to think about that, not only what they are doing in specific, but how that triggers us to think about the expansive opportunities ahead of us for our country and for the world. The United Nations ratified the Sustainable Development Goals last year around this time, just 1 month from now in September, a year ago. Those are the global goals that we set for this 15 years. And many of them would benefit from this technology and the creative ways that people will get up to solutions, whether they're supporting solutions for oceans and sustainability, for the inclusion in the entertainment industry, for agriculture, as I talked about already, and beyond, as well as the industry and the capabilities of building these kinds of technologies and supporting transportation and others. So we thank the museum and the team that's going to come this afternoon. I know you guys are going to be here at the White House this morning, and then moving to the museum, we're going to see some amazing demonstrations flying around there as well. So we thank that team and look forward to the whole day and the conversations that we'll get up to. I encourage you to make sure you meet at least 5 or 10 folks who you've never met before who are here in the room. And so we look forward to that. So with that, Administrator, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Megan. And it is great to be here. That was an interesting story that you told about the 4-H'ers. I spent 7 wonderful years in California 4-H clubs, and it sounds a lot different than what I remember when I was there, but they're certainly on the cutting edge and doing some very exciting things. Well, good morning, everyone, and thanks for taking part in our forum today. You know, American ingenuity has fueled our nation since its very earliest days, and it's created a lot of businesses that we've talked about, it's improved lives, it's cemented our place on the world stage. In fact, aviation is all about ingenuity. It's always how we can harness innovation and put it to great use for society. And we all know the story. It started with a pair of brothers who owned a bicycle shop. Neither of them were scientists, but they solved the greatest scientific challenge of their time. And it was a riddle and something that had baffled humankind for centuries. How on earth do we get in the air? Well, it continues to this day, where one of the most exciting sectors of the aviation industry doesn't even require a pilot to be physically present in the cockpit. Highly automated unmanned aircraft, as we all know, come in all different shapes and sizes. There are some that can fit in the palm of your hand, very small. Others can deliver packages. I saw one concept at the Consumer Electronics Show earlier this year that proposed using drones as a flying taxi. Now, as varied as these designs are, their potential uses go far beyond that. Unmanned aircraft are transforming entire industries, providing filmmakers with a fresh angle for looking at the world, and giving first responders a new and important tool that they haven't had in the past for things like search and rescue operations. They're improving the safety of our transportation infrastructure, whether it's inspecting miles of railroad tracks or miles of pipelines that crisscross our country. And they're tackling jobs that can be dangerous for people or other aircraft to do. Just last week, 2 people lost their lives in 2 different accidents involving crop dusters. Exactly the type of job that a small unmanned aircraft could do with much less risk to people and to property on the ground. Now, these are just a few of the examples of the potentials that drones have to change our world and to change it for the better, but there are many, many others. We all know that unmanned aircraft has sparked excitement among hobbyists and businesses alike, and manufacturers are stepping up to meet this interest. And now this is an industry that is moving at the speed of Silicon Valley, and we at the FAA know that we can't respond at the speed of government. America has the most complex airspace in the world, and it's the FAA's job to ensure that everything that's operating up there is doing it safely for the public and everyone who wants to use it. So we need to figure out how to incorporate and integrate unmanned aircraft and their users into this culture of safety and this culture of responsibility. But we need to do it in a way that doesn't stifle enthusiasm and doesn't stifle the potential of this growing industry. We found that the best way to accomplish this is to partner with a wide range of interests and a wide range of stakeholders in government, aviation, and technology. We're receiving valuable input on what the regulatory framework needs to look like and building consensus around things like public education campaigns. And it's helping us to make substantial progress on integrating unmanned aircraft into our airspace. And now we're taking the next step and formalizing this partnership. The FAA is chartering an unmanned aircraft safety team that will include a wide variety of different stakeholders from the drone and from the aviation industries. Now, this is modeled on what has been a very successful initiative, our commercial aviation safety team. And this group will analyze safety data to identify emerging threats that drones might pose to aircraft, people, and property, but also mitigation strategies to address those threats and to prevent accidents. We're also establishing the Drone Advisory Committee that will be chaired by Intel CEO Brian Krzyzewski. You're going to hear from him a little bit later this morning. This committee will help us prioritize our unmanned aircraft integration activities, including the development of future regulations and future policy. And it will include representatives from across the aviation spectrum. We'll be announcing the membership soon. Now, the creation of the Unmanned Aircraft Safety Team and the Drone Advisory Committee reflects the importance of this issue to the FAA and the value of our collaboration with all of the stakeholders. Now, we saw this firsthand last year when an industry task force developed recommendations that helped the FAA create a drone registration system in a few weeks. Now, that's not a timeline that is supposed to be possible in government. But by working together, we got it done. And today, we've registered more than 520,000 registrants for unmanned aircraft in just 8 months. Now, to put that in perspective, we have only 320,000 registered manned aircraft on the Aircraft Registry of the United States, and it took us 100 years to get there. So registration helps us to connect the drone with the operator in cases where people aren't following the rules, which is an important step forward in our oversight and enforcement efforts. And it gives us a great opportunity to educate the users about what are the rules of the air and how they should fly their unmanned aircraft safely. We've been encouraging operators to download our free smartphone app before you fly, which lets you know where it's safe and legal to fly a drone. If you turn it on here, you will find because of the secure airspace over Washington, D.C., it's not a great idea, but there are many other places where it is, and it's available for both Apple and Android devices, and it's already been downloaded more than 85,000 times. We use our ongoing No Drone Zone campaign to remind people to leave their unmanned aircraft at home during major public events, most recently the conventions in Cleveland and Philadelphia. Now, in addition to educating hobbyists, we're putting a regulatory framework in place to address the commercial use of drones as well. On August 29th, our first regulation for routine commercial use of small unmanned aircraft will take effect. Now, it allows unmanned aircraft weighing less than 55 pounds to fly in sparsely occupied areas up to 400 feet high and up to 100 miles per hour during the day. This rule is designed to allow commercial drone operations while minimizing risk to other aircraft, as well as to people and to property on the ground. And it will provide an important regulatory foundation for allowing additional operations in the future. Now we're partnering with private industry through our Pathfinder program to research activities that aren't covered under the current rule. Companies including CNN, Precision Hawk, and the BNSF Railroad have committed extensive resources to studying urban operations over people and flights beyond visual line of sight, and they're sharing that information broadly with us. The information received from Pathfinder, along with our work at the FAA's drone test sites, are helping us to draft our next round of regulations. We hope to propose a rule on unmanned aircraft operations over people by the end of this year. Now, some have called the birth of unmanned aircraft the Wright brothers' moment of our time. And that may be so, but if there's one thing that I'm sure of, it's that the only limit of this technology is our imaginations. And as we all know, our nation has no shortage of that. Safely integrating drones into our airspace is one of our top priorities at the FAA, and it's very important that we get it right. It's essential for our economy and our role as a global aviation leader. I'm very confident that by working closely with our partners in the aviation industry, in the unmanned aircraft industry, we will succeed and continue being a model for the rest of the world. So thank you very much for participating in this forum today. I'm really looking forward to what comes out of it. Thanks again. And now I'd like to introduce Brian? Brian, come on up. Brian Krzatich, CEO of the Intel Corporation.
Wow. Okay, I'm just super excited to be here this morning. One, just a prestigious location and venue, but also it's a chance to really talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is the UAS topic. I thought I'd start my presentation this morning or my talk with a little bit of a different approach around unmanned aircraft. And hopefully it shows you that there's a diversity of use and some real beauty in them as well. So hopefully this will work. Uh-oh, see? Some things, even in technology, don't always work. Ah, there we go. Now, that was approximately 100 drones flown by. There's always the last little bong. That was approximately 100 drones flown by one control system and at Sydney's celebration this summer. We have plans to scale this to 300, 500, 1,000, and hopefully much, much more. As Michael said, you know, I think this whole technology has an opportunity to really not only drive, enhancements in the economy, but also change the way we have experiences. And that was a way we really believe that we can replace fireworks over time with those types of devices. And when you see, 1,000 of them creating images in the sky and the ability to do just about any image you could imagine, you can start to imagine how that would change. And think of the additional safety of not having explosive devices over your head as a participant and not having firework factories having to create those devices. All of those things can be changed by this and have a, what we believe is a much better experience. So that's just one example of this. I think, you know, if you take a look at the numbers, the estimate is on the consumer side, $16 billion business by 2020. On a commercial side, probably somewhere on the order of $4 billion or more by 2020. If you look over the next decade, the estimates are this will contribute something like $80 billion to the economy. And what we believe is there's a few things that have to be driven in order to really drive this technology and this capability further. One is continuing technology innovation, and we'll talk a little bit about what we see as some of the critical factors that have to keep moving forward. The second thing is a collaborative ecosystem. We believe that, you know, there needs to be multiple companies. There's no one technology or design that's going to absolutely win in every application. If you look at the aircraft world of today, you know, you see that same kind of robust ecosystem, and especially if you look earlier in its lifehood. And then the last thing is leadership and policy and regulation. And as Michael said earlier, there's been great advancement, and there are still some things that we need to overcome. And it's really this partnership between what are the regulations and how do we do the safety, and how do we develop the technologies and the innovations to make that really what I believe be the industry that's even safer than the brother and sister aviation industry. So if we take a look at this, I'd like to talk a little bit about the technology imperatives, and we think there's a few of them. One is collision avoidance. You know, if you start thinking about the ability of doing inspections of airplanes, of inspections of cell towers, inspections of all kinds of devices with these technologies, you really want to make sure there's collision avoidance. You want to also, if you go into airspace and you go and have more people start to use these in a commercial application, you need to really think about collision avoidance. And as I showed you with 100 drones, 300 drones, 1,000 drones, separated by only a few meters, that collision avoidance becomes critical. There's a lot of technologies that are being developed. We brought one example of one. It's here with technology. And we literally are at the edge of collision avoidance drones that literally you cannot run into things. You cannot allow them to hit surfaces. So collision avoidance, we believe, is one of the technologies that's going to be critical for these moving forward. The next thing is connectivity and communications. So as we want to go out and go further away, we want to see in more diverse areas, we need to really improve our connectivity. You know, we have 4G today, but as the world of 5G comes out as we go through this decade, that's going to become more and more critical, especially when you start talking about operating these within city parameters where 4G connections aren't always available and aren't always robust, going out into the more far out reaches. All of those places are going to require better and better connectivity. So another one of the things that are required for technology and innovation. And then, as we showed you in that quick video, multi-drone operation. We believe that to be safely monitoring and managing multiple drones at once is going to become a critical factor for commercialization. And I always use this as an example. If it was you who was lost in a forest or out in the desert or wherever, and you had a choice of somebody walking in with one drones or trying to drag up 100 pilots with 100 drones, or one person could show up and send 100 drones out to search for you, which would you rather have as a scenario looking for you when you're lost in whatever location that is? I think we'd all choose that one person shows up with 100 drones, pushes a button, and out they go. And they're monitoring and managing those drones and looking for you. That's a much better scenario and a much more efficient scenario. And we really see that as an example of why multiple drones. And you can think of delivery or search and rescue or even inspection, you know, a swarm of drones inspecting a bridge for cracks and deficiencies. You know, that's the kind of application. You know, we talk about the infrastructure and the aging infrastructure in the U.S. This is a way to quickly go out and understand the status and condition of that infrastructure in a very precise way. And that's why we believe having the multiple drone technologies is absolutely critical. And then as you add all these together, we have to add more and more capability on the drones. So the drones have to become smarter. They have to integrate the multiple drone environment. They have to integrate the collision avoidance. They have to be switching between connectivity. And all of those scenarios require more and more compute capability and really software capability on the drone itself. They really have to become much more of an autonomous vehicle in this world. Okay. You put all of these together, and we believe these are the things that are going to be required for long-range, far-out-of-sight types of operation. And you can really think of this as the autonomous vehicle in the air type of application, where, again, we have collision avoidance on board, so the system can self-correct. You have navigational capabilities. You have connectivity through long-range. All of those things coming together for out of and beyond line of sight. And these are the types of technologies that we think are going to be critical for us moving forward. The next thing that we've talked about is a collaborative ecosystem. And there's many people out developing what I'll call developer boards, or boards that are really designed to bring people up quickly in their applications and usages and building of drones. I've shown you one example here, but there are multiple systems out there. And what these do is jumpstart the innovators and allow them to build a drone together in a commercial way, integrate that all of those capabilities we just talked about, the connectivity, the collision avoidance, the compute capability, all of those in a very quick way, and get to what do they want to do with this? What's the application? What's the usage model? And there's a lot of, one of the things I've learned about the small UAS system an ecosystem is this is a very collaborative organization and group. And we actually, even though there are many, many competitors in this environment, about once a quarter we actually get together for a dinner or a lunch and actually start talking about what do we see as the roadblocks, what are the hurdles that we all need to come in. And we're starting to invite the FAA to these dinners and lunches now as well. So it really becomes a collaborative environment. And we're all just striving to outrun where the technology could possibly go. And then the last thing, as we've talked about, is leadership and policy and regulation. And I really want to recognize the FAA here for the progress they've made. Having the small UAS rule set, Part 107, come out, understanding what the rules are, registration for drones. I'm one of those 500,000 people who have registered their drones. And I'm also one of the people who will be taking the test, hopefully on August 29th, for the commercial drone pilot license. We'll see. There's a little bit of a contest in our office to see who will get the highest score on the test. I don't know. If I'm not the highest, we won't publish our results, so I'll just tell you that much. these are all huge steps in giving people, and what I always say is, don't tell me what I can't do. Just tell us what we have to invent. Tell us what we have to overcome. Give us those rules, those methods. What is it that we need to invent? And this industry and the way the technology world works, we'll go invent it. And then we'll all have the ability to grow, to be safe, and to really lead the world and this industry. The partnership with the FAA is a fantastic example of how we're working together to really do that. So when I take a look at this, when you look at the regulatory issues, there's quite a few. And we're really dealing with everything from privacy to spectrum to safety and to scalability. Really thinking about how do you scale this across the country? How do you scale this in dense populations and remote populations? How do we really think about safety as we start to move over populated areas? As spectrum, as I said, as 5G comes out, how do we understand how the usage of 5G will be by these devices? And then clearly there's privacy concerns. As more and more of these systems get in the air, privacy will have to be something that we really need to think through and provide for people. But all of these can be solved with technology if we just understand what it is we want to deliver. And that's the key. So with that, I'd just like to thank you. I believe that we have a great roadmap ahead. There's a unlimited possibility, and this is a huge opportunity for the U.S. to lead from a technology, from a regulatory, and from a commercialization standpoint. And this truly can not only bring better experiences, but make our world, as Mr. Huerta said earlier, a safer place. We can save lives through this technology, and that's really why I'm really excited about this. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name's Ed Felton. I'm Deputy U.S. Chief Technology Officer, and I will be moderating the next session, which is a series of lightning talks on innovative applications of drones. Unfortunately, the last speaker listed on the program is not able to be here today, so we will have five lightning talks, and I will introduce each lightning speaker in lightning fashion and then get out of the way. So our first speaker is Mark Bathrick from the U.S. Department of the Interior.
All right, so I get to be the first, and hopefully I won't go over, so all my colleagues won't be mad at me. First, I'd like to thank the White House for putting on this fabulous event. I'd also like to thank you for this opportunity to talk about our 10-year program in 4 minutes. And since I'm the first, I'm going to tell you that of all the federal programs on the domestic side, we have the most diverse and the most experienced, most diverse program in UAS. And likely that's because of not only the great team we have, but also because of the great partnership we have with the FAA, our partners at NASA, Department of Defense, and of course, industry. So here we go. So why UAS for the Department of the Interior? Of all the federal departments in the United States, we manage the most land within the United States. 500 million acres, or about one in every 5 acres. In addition to that, 1.7 billion acres on the outer continental shelf. Our mix of missions is very diverse. Everything from fire suppression, mine inspection, search and rescue, oil response, critical infrastructure monitoring. And of course, we have limited resources and infrastructure, so UAS make the perfect vehicle for this. Science drives a lot of our decision making, a lot of our policy making, and UAS provide us with opportunities for better science, better resolution, increased persistence, repeatable scenarios, and employing state-of-the-art sensors leads to better decision-making. Also, improves our safety because we're able to reduce the exposure of employees to air and ground threats. We operate in some very remote and very hazardous terrain. It also allows us to enter some very hazardous environments. We tend to go towards earthquakes and towards volcanoes and towards firefighting. So this gives the opportunity to be safer. And savings. Initially leveraging excess DoD assets, we were able to do operational test and evaluation so that we could get our requirements in line so we could then go to industry and tell them what we needed. We're also able to replace a lot of those traditional ground methods of gathering data and science by using unmanned aircraft. And finally, service. Instead of going down to the airport and jumping in our helicopter aircraft, we pull our drone out of a backpack and we launch it, and we're able to get science in a much more responsive fashion. We're able to change sensors, and we're able to move with technology as it moves as well. So in the fire mission, we've already conducted several successful demonstrations and enhanced awareness, providing our firefighters and management teams with data that we can turn into actions in quick fashion. We provide eyes in the sky. We can even direct manned aircraft to drop with more accuracy. We see an expanded use of this in fire, and we expect that it'll become a huge tool in our firefighters' toolbox in the very near future. We're actually working on our first service contracts for wildland fire as we speak. Another unmanned aircraft that you may not be thinking of is a full-scale, optionally piloted aircraft. Again, we've done a couple of tests with these and they're very successful. We think this is going to be a game changer in our industry. It gives us 3 times the current support capability, the direct attack capability that we currently have available to us, able to operate at night and reduce visibility. We can do initial and direct attack, and actually increases by 4 times the supply and resupply capability that we've got. It also offers us an opportunity to do emergency extraction of injured firefighters, which is very much a big interest to our firefighters. And something that the small drones don't offer is that size and redundancy of systems. Search and rescue, again, able to go 24/7 now with search and rescue and put these aircraft where we wouldn't want to put a helicopter right up against these cliffs. In the natural resources area, we're able to go out and use aviation where we've never been able to use it before, we're able to find artifacts, find cultural resources that we've never seen before, like these cliff dwellings to the left, and we're also able to go out and demonstrate the uses of our public lands that we operate on. Finally, as the administrator said, the future is just limited by our imagination. And I would say the interior, we've got quite a bit of imagination. We're going to be using these to tag animals, to mitigate avalanche threats. And we look forward to partnering with industry and the rest of the federal government. Thank you.
Our second lightning speaker is Phil Moeller from the Edison Electric Institute.
Good morning. I'm Phil Moeller with EEI, the Edison Electric Institute. EEI is the Association of Investor-Owned Electric Utilities in the country. Prior to joining EEI, I spent 9 years as a commissioner at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And we also want to say thanks to the Office of Science and Technology Policy for holding this meeting today. The electric industry is big and increasingly important to all the citizens in the country, as electricity plays a more important part of daily life as we move on. We're focusing on 3 areas going forward: delivering more cleaner energy for the consumers in this country, having customer solutions that meet the needs of people who consume electricity, and modernizing the electric grid. And the key really is the grid, because that's what delivers not only a lot more clean energy, usually generated in remote locations, but also at the distribution level, the kind of smart energy technologies that allow people to get the options that they want. EEI members operate in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and provide electricity for 220 million Americans, or about 70% of the electric power industry in the United States. Our members are committed to delivering safe, reliable, affordable, and clean energy that powers our daily lives and drives the economy. The safe use of unmanned aircraft system, UAS or drones, will help electric companies improve the reliability, resiliency, and security of the energy grid, which ultimately benefits electricity customers. EEI members have embraced the use of drones, and many companies are flying them today to quickly and efficiently inspect critical assets. This slide shows you the service territory of the 15 EEI members that received FAA Section 333 exemptions. As you can see from the map, especially contrasted to the other one, there is room for expansion, and we believe the new FAA rules were an important first step that will encourage many more companies to fly, thanks to the FAA. Why are EEI members interested in drones? Well, as I mentioned, a key priority for our industry is building a smarter energy infrastructure that is more dynamic, resilient, flexible, and secure. Drones will be a key part of that effort. It takes a lot to deliver the energy that powers America, and all of our infrastructure must be inspected regularly. That can be done via drone, whether it's the more than 5,600 electricity generating stations, 45,000 substations, 382,000 miles of transmission line, or 3.4 million miles of distribution line that our companies own, operate, and maintain. However, most drone flights are limited to visual line of sight. EEI's member companies will be able to do many things even with that restriction. But we believe safely using drones beyond visual line of sight, BVLOS, is a key to delivering the most consumer benefits, especially enhanced reliability. That's why we've teamed with Sharper Shape, an industry leader that pioneered BVLOS utility inspection in Europe. In the coming weeks, Sharper Shape will bring an application on our behalf to the FAA for BVLOS demonstration flights in the U.S. FAA approval of that application will allow EEI companies to continue to move forward with this technology. Why do we need BVLOS? Most utility applications will be made more efficient with that, but there is one area where it is necessary for success: disaster response and restoration. The pictures you see here are from Hurricane Katrina, the June 2012 derecho, and Superstorm Sandy. I've included a quote from Duke Energy, one of EEI's member companies. Duke operates in six states that see a fair amount of severe weather. The bottom line is this: beyond visual line of sight will allow our companies to get the lights on quicker, and sometimes more importantly, the air conditioning and the heat. And with increased frequency of inspections, perhaps prevent them from even going out in the first place. And that's where we hope the dialogue will continue. We look forward to working with Congress, with the administration, with the FAA, and many other agencies to deliver the benefits of UAS. Thanks again for holding this workshop.
Our third lightning speaker is Robin Murphy from Texas A&M.
As a scientist, I think about disasters and drones in terms of numbers, numbers such as 2005. That was the first year a small UAS was used for disaster response, and that was Hurricane Katrina when we flew for the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue. Since then, 26 major disasters where we've seen UAS used in 15 countries, so they are in use. But let me tell you the story of a particular disaster, just one of the many kinds, and the number one. Flooding is the number one disaster in the United States and in the world. 200 deaths a year in the United States associated with flooding. And it's expensive. Since 1978, just on the flood insurance, the United States has spent $51 billion. And we are $24 billion in deficit. Drones can change that. And let me show you how drones are changing that. Here's some footage from of disasters where UAVs have been used at, most of which is with us, flying with our partners, such as US Data Wing, or with Roboticists Without Borders. Justice Adams is flying there. Now, looking at this, you can see all of the emergency response and recovery operations, getting that immediate eyes on, figuring out what's happening with people. Are they in distress? Can you get to them? Can they get out? Starting to think simultaneously about the insurance. Can we estimate property damage, both to declare a federal disaster quicker to get more response initiatives, but also to help them get recovered, to get back on their feet, and just think about agriculture, livestock. And now what about the public, understanding the risk, preparing, getting to understand the public accountability, projecting what's going to happen. Nice work here with USAA and Precision Hawk on how do you use this quick and easy way of getting digital elevation methods. And of course, inspecting infrastructure and making sure that the flood doesn't take out a few weeks later a bridge from downwashing there. So as you can see, these are changing right as we speak what we can do with disasters. Let's go back now to the numbers though. So as I told you, flooding is the number one disaster, but it's not the only disaster that UAVs can be used at. We've got earthquakes, superstorms, hurricanes, and of course, wildland firefighting. Keep in mind, every year, there's an average of 60 federally declared disasters. And that's not even counting what happens at the local and state. $7 billion gets put into FEMA just for that immediate response. We're not talking about the cost in insurance. We're not talking about the cost in job productivity. We're not talking what happens to us as individuals or that it takes you 6 months to get your insurance claim processed. We're just talking $7 billion there. Resilience, our economy can't be resilient with those kind of numbers. But UAS provide us one final number that I think will help, a number that you'll like. They're cheap. They're 100 times cheaper than a manned helicopter assets. And so I say, we need more drones and we need them now. Thank you.
Our fourth lightning speaker is Robbie Hood from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. And those of you who may know a little bit about NOAA may not realize that we are considered the America's Environmental Intelligence Agency. That's because our job is to collect information and help all of you have a better understanding of what's happening in the world. And we use data every single day. It has to be timely, reliable, actionable, and based on really solid science. What we want to do is to be able to give you the information you need to understand what's happening on the Earth and in our environment today and what's going to happen tomorrow. And with that information so that you can make smart decisions and be prepared for the future. So to do our jobs, we need lots and lots of data. And we have lots and lots of observing systems within NOAA. We have satellites, we have ships, we have aircraft, rain gauges, ocean buoys, radars, all kinds of things, just to name a few. But in order to make sure that we are providing the best data possible, we do need, and we have a priority in our agency to invest in our operational observing infrastructure. And we want to make sure that we're bringing in the best innovations when they are mature and ready and affordable so that we can start making sure that we're turning out the best product. So that is the reason we've been investigating how to use UAS within our agency. We're looking at ways to, so that we can collect data that are less expensive, or think ways that we can collect data and collect more quickly. We're also looking at, as many of the other speakers says, how we can collect data that put people at less risk. And then also, are there places that we can't get to right now, or times when we can't get data that we want to be able to move forward and get those observations? So since 2008, NOAA has been seriously investigating UAS activities within our agency, and we're looking at how we can enhance both our weather, climate, coastal, oceanic, and our sea life. We do a lot with fisheries and marine wildlife, how we can make all of that have a better understanding of what we're doing there. So as you can see on the slide here, we've looked at a wide range of platforms, from the really very small ones that fly very, very low, have short endurance, to the very large Global Hawk kinds of activities that have long range and long endurance. We're really interested in easy deployable systems and that can take data rapidly. And also, one of the major projects we have ongoing right now is we're actually looking at high altitude, long endurance UAS to see how we could use them if we ever had a major problem with one of our weather satellites. We don't want the skill of forecasting to be hampered, especially in situations where we have high impact oceanic weather, like hurricanes or storms at sea in the Pacific. So in the next few years, we are really focusing on trying to bring this capability into our agency. We run regular tests on a regular basis and have partnered with many, many academic advisors, other federal agencies, and private industry. So some of the things, precise things that we're looking at, we are, within the next year, we are going to be working with an optionally piloted UAS that can be flown from with either a pilot on board with or without a pilot. This is a medium altitude aircraft, and we're going to be using it to collect very precise gravity measurements. Now, this is important to us because we have to collect gravity measurements over the entire United States, and we take those gravity measurements and convert that to a vertical elevation of the surface. And this is really important because it helps us better understand what the sea level is and what the basically the elevation of everything in the United States. We turn around and use that to help with floodplain mapping and then also being able to better understand how our coastlines are aligned so that we can have the public be better prepared for tsunamis and hurricanes and storm surges. this particular activity that we're looking at, we're going to be actually adding in the data from the unmanned aircraft system into what we're already collecting with our manned aircraft. And we're really excited that the data that we collect with the unmanned aircraft is just as precise as what we're collecting now with manned aircraft, but also it's going to be cheaper to obtain because the fuel savings of an unmanned aircraft are so significant. Another thing we're looking at is how to use small UAS and really bring them into our agency, just like the Department of Interior did. So we use them on a regular operational basis. So we're looking at how to build a safety program, how to make sure that our scientists are well-versed in the proper operations, making sure that we have the data management and plans in place so that we can truly operate these on a regular basis. We're really excited about small UAS because we feel that'll give us very flexible, rapid response capability, very similar to the other agencies that you've heard talk about. We're especially interested in being able to monitor the changes in the Arctic and the Antarctic. There's a lot happening in the polar regions, and we want to have better understanding. And it's a very dangerous environment to collect observations. We're really interested in oil spills and chemical spills and having a better understanding of what's happening with our marine wildlife. Finally, another thing that we're taking a look at is how to expand the shipboard capabilities of the ships that we're using now and add small UASs to our shipboard operations so we can actually expand the observing radius of those ships. We use ships to look at weather, air quality, and monitor marine resources and wildlife out over the oceans. And so when we go to all the expense of taking a ship out to a remote part of the ocean, it really makes it more cost effective if we can take UASs with us to collect observations. I said finally, but I got one more thing I wanted to tell you about. And that is that within the next few years, we are looking at how to use UAS to actually collect weather data in real time. And to be able to put that data in real time to our weather forecast models. We have a study underway right now where we're using both a high altitude UAS and then also another kind of UAS that is launchable from a manned aircraft. And in both cases, we're flying higher than we can with a normal aircraft and be able to fly over storms, over the ocean, and look down through them and collect vertical observations that are much more, they're in higher resolution than what we can get to the satellite, but they augment the satellite very, very well. Another thing we're looking at is, like I said, an aircraft launch vehicle that can fly at very low altitudes out in the middle of a hurricane over the ocean and try to give us better understanding of what's happening, that interchange of the hurricane and the ocean. We have a project coming up this next year where we're looking at small UAS to be used in Oklahoma and other places. Oh, I'm sorry, did I miss? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm good. This is my last one, so I'm very sorry. So anyway, we're looking at how to use UAS to look at hurricanes and move forward. So thanks again for welcoming us, and we really appreciate this opportunity.
Thanks. Our final lightning speaker is Sanjeev Singh from Carnegie Mellon University.
Okay. Good morning. I'm very happy to be here to give you the technologist view of UAS, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what we want drones to do. So, every day we hear something new, some new application, some new platform, some amazing things, and it would be a reasonable question to ask, are they trying to do the same thing? Are they something different? I'm going to suggest to you that there are really three classes that you might think about. Our first class might be what I'll call, we want drones to reach for us. And think about this as a very advanced selfie stick or a very tall ladder. What you're really doing is putting a camera somewhere up in the sky so you can get a point of view that hasn't been possible before. So if you want to see what it's like to go over the Niagara Falls in a barrel, you might be able to do that with a drone, okay? And you can go to YouTube and get these kinds of videos, and they're absolutely enlightening, in some cases very interesting. There's another class, a second class, that I'll call reveal. And what we're looking here is there's a unique opportunity with drones to be able to combine sensors at the same time and over time to produce what we'll call actionable intelligence. So this is the kind of intelligence that might tell a railroad line that the grade over at a particular part of the track has been washed out, or it might tell a power company that vegetation in this part is getting too close to the power lines, or it's getting, it might tell somebody else that there is some other kind of information that they can actually act on. If you want to inspect a bridge, for example, it's not just enough to have an eye in the sky. It would be really nice if we could have the data collated in such a way that would be able to tell somebody some information that they can make measurements and make useful kinds of judgments. A third kind of thing that we might think about in a third application might be what we just call transport. It's essentially carrying things from one to another. It might be taking bullets and bandages to troops. It might be delivering sushi or pizza to your favorite park, or it might be something very timely, such as delivering fire retardant in a forest fire. So the reason to separate these kinds of applications might be that if you look at these, there's a kind of progression of technology. I will contend that the technology for the first part is mostly here. You know, it's available in the form of a drone. The drones get more sophisticated. We have to respect certain kinds of things. You might want to have, as the CEO of Intel pointed out, some sort of devices to make sure that these things stay safe. But I think there's more and more gain to be had and more sophistication required as you move up the chain here. So what we see here, everybody would agree, tremendous potential for new applications and to transform aviation in general. And as you would expect a significant risk that must be mitigated. So here's the rub. You probably have heard that new technology comes to toys and jet fighters, okay? So when we look at this stuff, I think the danger here is that we might be attracted by the lower cost, the larger volume kinds of applications, the easy to use applications, but be expecting the jet fighter kind of reliability. So I think when we look at the middle ground here, the reveal, the providing the actionable intelligence, I think there is some work that still needs to be done here, and I'm going to talk to you about that. So where we might go for that is we might look at the progression of autonomy in self-driving cars. So in 1985, I went to Carnegie Mellon to work on the very first self-driving cars, and on the left is a thing called NavLab, and then a year later it was moving around autonomously at about walking speed. A few years later, in fact, almost a decade later, it was 5 meters per second. In 2007 at the DARPA Urban Challenge, it was going 10 meters a second, and very recently these things are moving at highway speeds. So, you know, one thing that we can learn from the self-driving car world is, well, you know, the autonomous air vehicles don't have to be as complicated as the technology here. We might not need 30 years to get up to where we can have useful vehicles, but we might also notice that each of these vehicles used a lot of equipment and sensors, computing, to be able to understand the world around them. Okay, so to the extent that the future air vehicles are going to operate close to the environment, low to the ground, you would expect that the autonomous air vehicles of the future are going to need the same thing. So, in fact, this is a full-scale helicopter that flies for the Office of Naval Research and the Marines, and it has a complete perception system that is very reminiscent of the kinds of systems that you see on the self-driving cars. Okay, well, maybe we're done, maybe we're not. What more is needed? We might ask that. So I would say the number one thing that is needed for air vehicles to be operating safely in the national airspace is for them to be able to deal with these off-nominal conditions. You know, much is to be said, well, you know, we can fly these things safely. Even children can fly them. Very, very simple to operate them. But we need to be able to deal with the off-nominal. It's not a very well-kept secret that if GPS were to go out, a lot of air vehicles would just drop out of the sky, autonomous air vehicles. So, you know, we need to make them make sure that they're able to deal with failures of propulsion, failures of sensors, so that they are continuously able to replan. And a second one would be self-awareness, to be able to see where they are and what's around me. A third one would be to scale up to a large number of UAS operating in national airspace. And this is, in fact, the agenda that the FAA has for what it would take for operating in national airspace. So I'm going to stop right here. Thank you.